please listen carefully.
Hello, world, and welcome to the Optimist Daily Update. I'm Christy Jansen, back from my failed attempt at taking a vacation.
And I'm Summers McKay, disappointed at Christy for not taking her vacation successfully.
We're part of the team behind the Optimist Daily, making solutions to the news. We bring you reader-funded solutions news every day in order to change the tenor of news media and the direction of your day to one focus on solutions.
6 days a week, we publish positive news stories written by our award-winning journalists and delivered online to your inbox and through our social channels. And because you are listening, because you are worth talking to, because we love sharing these solutions in a commute-worthy, walk-worthy, and home office-worthy podcast, we are back for another day. Today is Wednesday, May 6th. 2020. Now, Christy, let's just get right to it. Tell me how you failed at your staycation.
Well, I took off my mornings because I wasn't doing the update with you. But other than that, each day had other responsibilities that really called me out, and I didn't get my distancing from my screen the way that I had really wanted. So I kind of just was home and worked a little less, but I didn't really take a vacation.
Did you do anything fun?
Well, last night, my husband and I had some margaritas for Cinco de Mayo, which was really fun.
I mean, that's good. That is fun. I'm glad you guys at least had a little evening.
Yeah, it was really nice. And I did take Tucker for a longer hike. It was nice. I did get outside a bit more. It wasn't exactly the full disconnect that I was craving.
You know, I think it's probably impossible right now to fully disconnect just because the life and the world that we lead, and it's sort of hard because we're home and our computers are right there in our faces. You just can't totally get away. I know that the couple days that I'm taking off in a week include time spent taking Brennan to her 9-month-old doctor appointment and getting my car serviced, however creatively we're going to do that with masks and gloves and things. So I don't know if it will be fun, but I'm hoping that I'll be a little productive. I don't know. Anyway, we're glad to have you back. Amelia did a great job sitting in your seat. I'm not sure if you had a chance to listen. Hopefully you did not. We missed you, and welcome back. Why don't we go ahead and hit it off with today's solutions?
Of course. Well, our first solution comes from the health section on the Optimist Daily. COVID-19 pushes 300,000 people to quit smoking across the UK. We're all being a bit more conscious about our lung health during the COVID-19 outbreak. One positive outcome from the pandemic is that it offered the necessary push for 300,000 people in the UK to give up smoking. A joint study between YouGov and the campaign group Action on Smoking and Health, or ASH, took a comprehensive look at smoking rates across the country after health officials urged individuals to stop or cut back on smoking to improve lung resiliency to COVID-19. The study of over 1,000 people found that an additional 2.4 million have cut down on smoking, and 25% of respondents who quit said that COVID-19 made them less likely to relapse. Quitting smoking immediately reduces the risk of numerous health threats, including stroke and heart attack. But COVID-19's direct effect on lung function is an additional reason to quit, and for good. The rates of individuals giving up cigarettes could be boosted in part by the successful hashtag #QuitForCovid campaign on Twitter. You could say one benefit of the pandemic is that it has all of us paying closer attention to our health. It teaches us not to take our good health for granted and to be even more conscious about our lifestyle decisions. In Summers, this is a really good way of pointing out that boosting our immunity and just overall health is one of the things that's really going to help us get through this whole pandemic with the minimum amount of effect.
I have to say, I maybe have my rose-colored glasses on thinking that people just don't smoke as much as they used to anymore. I know that they do, and I know that smoking is still just a really pervasive and dangerous habit, as well as, you know, the expansion of vaping. And I'm really glad to see that people are stopping smoking. It breaks my heart that people still even do it. I did in college, right? It was the thing.
Yeah.
Nobody told us not to. Well, or if people told us not to, we were like, yeah, whatever. It's not that big of a deal. But it just still kind of blows me away that people are still smoking. So I'm really glad to hear people are stopping.
But we're here in California, where I think this is less of an issue. There's other places around the world where smoking is still very much in fashion. It's just sort of fallen out of fashion in our own backyard. But that doesn't mean that it's not really affecting a lot of people. And I think it's great to see that this might be the impetus to get people to put down down that cigarette.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the reasons, to your point, that it has fallen out of fashion is that largely smoking is illegal in California in public parks and in public areas. There are a lot of laws that have been put in place really reiterating the dangers of smoking. And that kind of leads us to our next story, which is another story about how laws can actually affect change in a positive way. So from the policymaking section, this court case shows people can force governments to achieve climate goals. While it might seem like a strange time for a government to start making new climate commitments, the Netherlands had little choice. A court case brought by environmental groups in 2014 and upheld by the Supreme Court last year has forced the government to act to reduce emissions to 25% below 1990 levels at the end of 2020 at the latest. It is climate action under extreme duress. There are more than 1,500 climate lawsuits, either complete or ongoing in the world, including similar cases in Ireland and Norway. But this is by far the most successful to date. Michael Gerard, the director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University, says the Dutch case is the strongest climate change decision ever issued by a court, and the only one that has truly forced government policy. The consequences of this are huge. It shows that people can hold governments accountable if they are not achieving the climate targets they set forth. Marjan Minesma, the head of the Urgenda Foundation, which filed the initial legal challenge, says the policies are a great victory for the rule of law, but points out that they won their initial case in a district court in The Hague in June 2015. Two appeals from the government caused the case to go on for 5 years, which is a whole lot of wasted time, a precious commodity in the climate crisis. The good news, however, is that the Netherlands is shifting course. Last month, a Dutch government announced a bold set of climate policies designed to reduce annual carbon emissions by nearly 10 megatons, comparable to the yearly output of Latvia. Additionally, several new coal power plants are set to be closed, while a 3 billion euro spending package will subsidize renewable energy products and home refits.
That's a great story, Summers. And I think one of the things that's interesting is Netherlands, while they do really well on certain indicators, they have actually not been really good at reducing their carbon emissions. So it's nice to see that they're shifting course in this way. I wonder if it's also linked to the adoption of that circular economy, the donate economy model for Amsterdam. Anyway, I'm optimistic about this.
I love seeing places all over the world taking on climate as actually something to get angry about, something to get legal about, and something to force change by way of enacting these lawsuits and these court cases to really say, hey guys, we're not just asking policymakers, hey, might you? Instead, we're going to force you to actually affect change. A really good story and excited to see, and well done to the Netherlands.
Moving on from our education section on the Optimist Daily, how one school in California is mastering online learning. Last week, the Optimist Daily took an in-depth look at how our education systems will be transformed post-coronavirus. Today, we're checking out the Anacapa School, a school in Southern California that is achieving high success rates with their approach to online learning. At a time where parents are becoming more frustrated with the way online learning is being handled by most schools, the Anacapa School in Santa Barbara is finding success by allowing students to explore their passions with guidance from dedicated teachers. For virtual learning, this involves real-time group collaboration in math class and on science projects, such as documenting ecosystems around their homes. Elective courses even include preparing for the regional entrepreneurship competition, which will be held online this year. One factor in the school's successful ratio in engaging online curriculum is the low 5-to-1 student-to-teacher ratio. The head of the school, Dylan Miner, says the success is in large part due to students' positive attitudes and resilient spirit about their education. Even facing the possibility of meeting via Google Hangout until next fall, the students are still enthusiastic about coming to class each day. There is a multitude of ways to adapt online learning to work for different age groups, and looking at schools that are managing to successfully run virtual classrooms is a great way to gain insight and inspiration for how we can all be better online teachers and administrators. This is a great story about how if you look outside the box and find models of innovation, we might be able to come out of this enforced learning virtually with new methods for using the tools of virtual online learning more creatively and productively in the post-COVID-19 pandemic era. One thing about Anna Kappa, though, is it is a small private high school, and it'd be great if we could bring some of this kind of creativity and ingenuity into our public school settings and support those teachers in more deep ways.
I think it's also it's about expanding the tools that are available. And while this small school in Southern California is doing really well, there are other small private schools in Southern California who are not doing well. And I think one of the keys on this one is really the collaborative relationship the families, teachers, students, and administration all have with one another in trying to make it work. I think communication is so essential. Schools that are doing better at this are asking for input, in my opinion, than those who are just saying to the parents and teachers, hey, this is what we're going to do. We recently sent out a pretty wide letter to high school and elementary school administrators, making sure they knew about the Optimist Daily and that it could be a class starting point for students and an additional online tool available for online education. I think the more positive sources of information that teachers can draw from, because really part of what we love about class and interaction in the classroom together is dialogue about real world subjects. And we need to give teachers the tools to continue that dialogue, even in an online forum. I'm with you, Christy, that this kind of skill set needs to be expanded to all schools, not just the small private ones, but also the larger public institutions that need support right now as well.
And let's make sure that all of the students have access to high-speed internet so they can actually get online. That's another good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some schools are just battling even getting their students online, and that is one of those pretty privileged perches that I continue to reiterate that those of us here in Southern California, where we have a ubiquitous high-speed internet, although it can make podcasting a little challenging, we are so fortunate, but there are a lot of places in the world that aren't, and that needs to be handled as well. Our next story from the business section of the Optimist Daily, coronavirus has brought local back into the spotlight. You might imagine the post-pandemic world as being one where humanity is left picking up the shattered pieces just to glue them back to the state they were before, but that won't necessarily be the case. While the crisis has turned many aspects of our society upside down, it's also greased some wheels that may make things run better once the pandemic blows over. Among the bright spots is the newfound appreciation of healthcare workers, school teachers, waste handlers, police, EMT, and other essential employees, not to mention the brave shopkeepers and restaurant workers whose establishments remain open to enable us to buy food, medicine, liquor, and other vital goods, margaritas. There are also glimmers of hope about the world that will be stepping into a not too distant future. In particular, there's the rebirth of local. Local what exactly? Well, local food, local manufacturing, and retail, among other things. Local food systems, especially, are becoming increasingly appreciated and valued, from community-supported agriculture to grow-your-own gardens, farmers markets, and direct-to-consumer sales by local farmers. These growing trends coincide with a growing interest to become more self-reliant, as well as an increasing trend of cooking at home and the search for healthy options during homebound months. Similarly, local retail also stands to gain once folks are released from their sheltering at home. According to a recent study by EY, consumers show a greater preference for shops, restaurants, and brands that feel local. The research found that more than 4 in 10 consumers expect their shopping habits to change drastically in a post-COVID world. About a third said they would be willing to pay more for local brands. The return of manufacturing is another part of the new localism. The pandemic provided a wake-up call about the importance of having local manufacturing base. The ability of factories to quickly pivot to make masks, PPE, testing kits, hand sanitizer, and other vital goods during a critical moment has demonstrated the need to bring back significant manufacturing and production capabilities to the U.S. shores. And then there's that circular economy, specifically the part where people are reusing, repairing, and sharing more than ever. Secondhand, for example, is experiencing a revival. A recent survey has indicated that the coronavirus has dramatically shifted resale shopping behavior in the baby and kids category. I know that one to be true. 39% of parents reported buying secondhand. Granted, it's early days and a lot of this will be slow in coming, but as we claw our way back to health, we shall do so with a renewed focus on local and resilient communities as we collectively work to ensure that we can better survive whatever calamity is next to come. Christy, I know that even our personal behavior at home, when suddenly an Amazon delivery is no longer 2 days away, you're looking local. When suddenly toys for Brennan or diapers that she's outgrown are really a resource, I'm thrilled to share those with my neighbor or participate in, you know, resale and secondhand in ways that we have never been before. This is definitely part of what we're calling at the Optimist Daily, a resilient reopening back to better.
I like that. And not back to the usual, but actually reimagining and reinventing our society, our communities. I love that. All right. Well, our final story for the day is from the energy section on the Optimist Daily. It's about how renewables took over the grid during the pandemic. There has been a winner to emerge from this coronavirus pandemic. It would be the solar industry. The reduction in driving, flying, and industrial activity due to the COVID-19 pandemic has led to smog-free skies, which is proving a boon for solar energy generation. Pollution blocks solar radiation, and the fine particles spat out during combustion can settle on the surface of solar panels, reducing their efficiency. But smog-free skies, along with a lucky combination of sunny days and cooler temperatures, which also boost panel efficiency, have helped solar panels break records in the UK, Germany, and Spain this spring. The trend points to the potential for a positive and hopeful feedback loop. As polluting energy sources are replaced by solar panels, those solar panels will be able to generate more electricity. In Germany, a record that was set in March was broken again on April 20th, when solar generated 40% of the country's electricity. It's actually not unusual to see solar generation records broken in this time of year, when new panels installed in winter get their first time to shine in the spring weather. While the added capacity explains some of the solar grid's takeover, the drop in electricity demand right now due to the pandemic has also inflated its proportion in the total mix. In the UK, record solar power generation also helped coal plants set a major record, but of the opposite kind. The entire UK energy system ran with zero coal-fired power plant generation for more than 18 days in a row, something we wrote about last week. While it's hard to say how the renewable industry will emerge from a potential recession, a new study by clean energy research firm Bloomberg NEF paints an optimistic picture that renewable energy takeover will continue on a global scale. The financial research firm found that utility-scale solar farms and onshore wind farms now offer the cheapest source of electricity for about two-thirds of the world's population. The study finds that falling costs, more efficient technology, and government support in some parts of the world have fostered larger renewable power plants, with the average wind farm now double the size it was 4 years ago. And the larger the plant, the lower the cost of generation. The price of electricity from onshore wind farms dropped 9% since mid-2019, and solar electricity prices likewise declined 4%. In any case, the pandemic has shown us the very real value of renewable energy and the smog-free skies that boost them. This is another good outcome from our enforced pause in the world economy. I just hope that as things start to open up again, we hold on to these gains in clear skies and clean energy, and also think about how are we going to store all this electricity and use it in a productive and efficient way going forward. Anyway, this is a great story and I like it. That's a great way to end today's podcast.
Well, yeah, Christy, you constantly remind our team that optimism is not hope. Optimism is a commitment to change. And the stories that we have read today are definitely in that commitment to change, whether it is a cessation of smoking to forcing policy by way of lawsuits, even the next level of microgrid or localization. This is the change that we can expect and demand in our concerted efforts of optimism. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Optimist Daily Update. We promise to continue to share positive, solution-based stories with ideas on how you can participate in this changing world and ensure it is changed for good. We promise to cover the current events with accuracy, legitimate sources, and offer you the information needed most to chart new paths for all of us.
And please consider becoming an emissary on theoptimistdaily.com. For just $5 a month, support reader-funded independent journalism and be a part of the solution-changing consciousness and addressing our world's biggest challenges with a problem-solving mindset. Thanks, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Have a great day, guys. Happy hump day.